State Affairs Committee is in session of forum as present, Santa Sturczewski, Kelly and myself, Vic Fisher. We have a large number of items on our schedule today, and if we can, we'll get through them as expeditiously as possible. We have for a month and a half been working on drunk driving legislation. We now have House Bill 6, which was passed by the House, which is the drunk driving bill that we have essentially been using as a basis for the committee's deliberations. Last week, we reviewed a series of amendments. We now have a CS before us that includes all but one of the provisions that we had discussed last time. And Susie, would you care to explain the one change that we have in the proposed State Affairs Senate CS?
We did not put Amendment Number 5 into the proposed CS. That was the 4-hour provision, which would mean that as long as the breathalyzer test was taken within 4 hours of the time of the arrest, that person could presume that this was intoxicated. We did not put that provision in because we were contacted by a number of people, and it was suggested that the absorption rate is such that you cannot presume someone was intoxicated at the time of arrest if you take their PAC 4 hours later. So that was why that was
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is this bill is HB 6 exactly as it passed the House, plus those few items that we agreed to change on this committee.
Yes.
That is correct, except for the one change, and on page 4, line 9, a may was changed to shall.
Excuse me, that's on line 7.
Page 4, line 7. Where it says
four,
the department may issue a temporary permit that is valid. I don't think the intent was not to just be discretionary.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Something came up today that I'd like to ask some of the attorneys about. Something that knows something about prosecution and guidelines.
We have both a representative of the State Prosecutor's Office and Alan Bailey of the Anchorage Municipal College, Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor. Would you both please come up? I hope you will.
Pardon?
I hope you won't go through all those papers.
I'll try not. I don't know what questions you're asking.
Would you just, for the record, and the tape, identify yourselves, please?
I'm Alan Bailey. I'm the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor.
My name is Dale Horetsky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize to the committee for not having brought this question up before, but it just came to my attention this afternoon. I got a call from Anchorage from a gentleman who was injured, and his wife was injured by a DWI accident several weeks ago. Seriously injured, both of them. The wife might be permanently injured. The facts of the case, at least as I read them in the newspaper and as I heard them from this person, indicates that the person, the other driver, attempted to do serious bodily harm. He followed him at high speeds without lights on. When the person that I talked to pulled out the side of the road to talk to the state trooper, the guy just ran into the back of his car without any skid marks. It's the understanding of this person I talked to that person is simply going to be charged on a DWI charge, which will only result in 3 days in jail. Now, is this the proper bill to address a situation like that when a DWI charge also involves a serious bodily injury?
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Senator Kelly, I'm not familiar with that case specifically. I don't know if that was an arrest by an Anchorage Police Department officer or what. There are laws right now under Title 11, which is our criminal code, which allow felony charges to be brought against a person if they are driving in a negligent manner, which results in serious physical injury to another person. It would be an assault charge, which is a felony charge. In order for a person to be charged with a felony, the case has to be taken to the district attorney's office and screened by our screening officer to decide what felony charges, if any, are appropriate. And I don't know if that occurred and if, for some reason, the case was declined or if it's being reviewed or any of those facts. To answer your question, a person who drives while under the influence of intoxicating liquor and is involved in an accident which causes serious physical injury to another person can, under current law, be charged with a felony. So I think the inquiry would be more into what happened in that particular case rather than any kind of a legislative action in terms of the law. The law in that area is very clear and does not, in my opinion, need to be altered at this point.
If I did choose to alter that, is this the vehicle to do it, or would it take a separate bill on a Title 11 change?
Choose to alter what, sir?
If I chose to strengthen the assault provision on DWI cases.
I believe you could do it in HB 6 if it refers to somebody who's under the influence at the time he's driving. It would be an amendment to Title 11, however, not to Title 28. Thus far, all of the provisions in this bill are in Title 28.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a question on the, in the area of revoking of the driver's license. You don't see any problems, do you, with that, any constitutional problems, the way that's come out? We're allowing the, we're able to move more quickly to revoke a driver's license. You don't see any problems with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sturgalewski, this duty substitute was handed to me, as I said, in back of the room, so I haven't had a chance to read it. An administrative revocation in and of itself does not present constitutional problems, no. I haven't been able to read this carefully. I understand that there have been some changes just from what Ms. Trick indicated. One of the problems with the way it's drafted now, administratively, not constitutionally, but administratively, is that if a person comes in and asks for a hearing to contest the revocation, mm-hmm. even if it's beyond the 7-day limit, he or she automatically gets a temporary license, which is good until the date of the hearing. So there's a great deal of incentive under the current version of this bill for a person to file for an administrative hearing because that's how he or she keeps his license. And even if the 7-day period has elapsed, they can still file, and they can still, as of the way it's been changed there on line 9, the department shall issue mm-hmm. a temporary permit. It's not even a discretionary. If a person files for a hearing, he or she gets a temporary license. And that is going to add a great deal to the number of hearings you're going to have because nobody wants to lose their license.
The language, though, is that if you show good reason, then the department shall. The problem that we ran into was that we were also advised that if you just revoke it and pending appeal without proper cause, do not issue a license, even if the revocation might be voided afterward. If there's a serious question pending an administrative hearing, that we would be causing more problems than we'd be solving with that provision.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this bill, or portions of it, was modeled under a similar law, which is in effect in Minnesota. Under Minnesota's law, if you have 7 days to file for a hearing to stay the revocation. If you miss that 7-day period, you can get an administrative hearing. You're not precluded from your appellate, if I may use that word loosely, remedies, but you don't get a temporary license in the meantime. And this says if the person shows that the person for good cause was unable to make a timely request, I guess ultimately that would be up to the department to say what was good cause for unable to make a timely request. That good cause is not further expanded to indicate what that would be.
Mr. Chairman?
It just seems to me that we should consider the May issue. When you talk about the good cause, that really comes as to whether or not they should have a hearing.
That's right.
Not to the granting of the license. I mean, it's for cause that they can extend and go ahead and file after that. And I'm wondering if that's what we really want to do, is just give them back their license.
Well, so far as I'm concerned, the stricter the provisions are, the happier I'll
be. It seems like may, in this case, would be stricter than shall.
Or you may leave it discretionary with the department if the person shows certain things beyond a 7-day period. He or she can get it, like if they show they were actually in the hospital during that 7-day period and it was physically beyond their capability of filing, then maybe you want to consider giving them a temporary license. But if their, quote, good cause, unquote, is, well, I didn't know I should get a lawyer until my brother-in-law told me maybe I should better, and by that time, 14 days had elapsed. I mean, some people might see that as good cause and somebody else might not, and maybe if this committee has an opinion about that, good cause ought to be either further defined or some other standard set.
I have no objection at all going back to May.
I personally would prefer that. It gives some discretion. Do we need, then, if we do that, to call for some kind of standard? I think it would be helpful. But that's where you get into.
Can we do it right here? I hate to hold a bill over again.
That might be the sort of thing that regulations would be appropriate. I'm just throwing that out. I don't know.
If it can be done by regulations, then we don't need to put it in here. I want to bring another issue. Did you have any more questions?
No, that then okay. We're agreed that
It'll be May.
May.
Right.
That'll be changed.
Right. Another issue that I need to bring before you is section 13, that's on page 10, 2835-028, sobriety checkpoints. As you may remember, we talked about that several times, about putting that in, about having that as a letter of intent. We were advised as a letter of intent, it really sort of gets separated and wouldn't exist. At the same time, that we should very carefully phrase it so as not to make it look as if this is the sort of a favored vehicle and the police shall not use other means that they are presently are authorized to use to deal with drunk driving. So this section was phrased in accordance with our discussions here previously, sort of like a statement of intent, but without mandate. Okay, I just want to make sure that you had a chance to review it.
Mr. Chairman, there are two provisions. One is the preliminary breath test, and the other is the sobriety checkpoint. Is that correct?
Excuse me. No, they're totally unrelated to each other.
Yeah. It says may use preliminary breath tests at sobriety checkpoints.
Oh. The preliminary breath test.
But we've dealt with that separately, also.
Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned about the checkpoint not amounting to a roadblock in subsection B of 2835-028. That would be line 7 mm-hmm. on page 10. The reading I've done indicates that checkpoint is just a nice word for a roadblock, and that the generic activity you're conducting, they like to call it a checkpoint when it amounts to a very minimal delay for drivers. And I'm concerned that it might well be demonstrated that that any useful sobriety checkpoint constitutes a roadblock in the dictionary meaning, perhaps. And you might be defining yourself out of business here.
I assume this was the proper language. I have hold no cause for this one.
We could delete that one.
Yeah. Would we lose anything by deleting this?
I don't think so.
The whole section.
No, not the amounting to a roadblock. And the commas in front.
Yeah.
And behind. is deleted. Let me make a suggestion, Alan, since you have not been part of this. This bill next goes to the Judiciary Committee, and you might want to review the whole bill just from the standpoint of your municipal experience in Anchorage, and I advise Senator Ray, Senator Josephson, and myself as to you know, any suggestions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will review it and contact you.
I think that's basically it.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the committee pass that Senate CS for House Bill number 6 State Affairs with the two amendments you made today. I mean, incorporated into the CS, right, with individual recommendations.
Motion is to pass out the committee, Senate State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill number 6 with individual recommendations.
I'll be a due pass.
I'm a due pass.
We'll have lots of due passes. There being no objection, we will so do. We next have House Bill 17, which is in the bound folder still, I believe. We have a, where is it? House Bill. What's that? All right. We have the bill that's passed by the House. Where is the proposed CS?
The proposed CS is still in the back.
Okay, about 3-4 tabs back is the proposed CS. And we've run into a problem as outlined in May 17 memo from Russ Josephson on the effective date aspects.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I've read the proposed memo. I'm not sure I agree with him on Section 19. I suspect he's right on Section 20. I'm a strong supporter of the rule that we don't change the title in the other house. I think that we should give it a fair try. And since it was my proposed CS, I would withdraw the proposed CS and go with House Bill 17 as it passed the House, and to move it out of committee, if it's a committee. Now, the only other provisions, I guess, were Senate Bill 88, which we'd incorporated into it, but I'll just try to make certain that bill gets passed in the House, if in fact it gets passed.
All right, we have before us then the House passed Bill 17, which is House Judiciary Committee CS, and no proposed amendments before us, if you want to move.
Mr. Chairman, then I would pass House Bill 17 out with individual recommendations, but I'm a due pass.
Motion's been made to pass House Bill number 17 out of the committee with individual recommendations. That being no objection, we'll so do. Next is someone called Adelaide?
Not yet.
This is it. Senate Bill 226. I'm not going to move that. I have problems with House Bill 17, and as a matter of principle, 226 falls in the same category of affecting a whole class of people beyond.
You're not moving. You don't.
I do. No, I'm proposing not to move.
226.
226. Is he going at that?
Yes, you're here in a second.
All right, next we have House Joint Resolution 28 dealing with Native allotments. It's sponsored by Adelaide Herman. As a proposed Senate State Affairs Committee substitute, which makes only some minor changes for clarity and accuracy in the resolution as passed by the House. The changes have been reviewed with and concurred and by the prime sponsor in the House. The whereas clause beginning at page 1, line 18 was written with no substantive changes. The number on page 2, line 8 was changed from 10 years to 77 years to reflect the fact that the allotment program started under the Native Allotment Act of 1906 rather than under ANCSA 1971. We have somebody here from DNR to testify. I'm not sure we need anyone to testify.
Mr. Chairman, unless they have some problem with the bill, if they're supportive of it, if there's a problem on it, I'd like to hear about it.
Is there anyone here who insists on testifying? If not, we will not hear from you.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Committee Substitute for HJR number 28, State Affairs. I'll be a due pass, individual recommendation.
If there's no objection, the bill will be, resolution will be moved out with individual recommendations. We next before us have House Bill 184, which is a bill dealing with certificate of titles for vehicles. And is anyone here to testify on that? On House Bill 184, which relates to issuing a certificate of title for vehicles except for registration.
Mr. Chairman, and members, my name is Wally Kivlin, and I represent Northern Oilfield Services. The reason for this legislation, in 1978, the legislature made some changes to the vehicle law. Last year, one of the banks foreclosed on a trailer. The result of the Supreme Court ruling was that you cannot get title to a car unless you have a license plate. Off-road vehicles in Alaska have never had to have license plates because they never get on the highways. Now, the people I represent bought some pickup trucks, shipped them to Kaparik, and when they went to get the title, they said, you can't get the title for the car until you buy license plates because of the Supreme Court ruling. As soon as you buy a license plate for cars, even though it might be out in the village going from a mile from the airport to the village where there's no highways going to the village, it would double your insurance. This was strictly a technicality that was not brought out until the Supreme Court ruling on the court case of a bank foreclosing on a trailer.
Mr. Chairman?
Carlos.
Just trying to go through this. What are the negatives to passing this bill?
Nothing. Excuse me.
I'm just going to say that in it, we had... a comment was made that we might expect to hear negatives from the banking industry, and I've heard no negatives from anybody. And are there negatives to
There's
passing
nothing.
The bill? Do we create other conflicts?
There's nothing at all, Senator Sturgiolski, that hasn't been in effect for years in the state of Alaska. If you have off-road vehicles, whether they're construction or out in the villages or on the North Slope, with cars that never get on a public highway, mm-hmm. have never had to buy a license plate. And now, if you're out in the village, you buy a car, and you go to sell it, you don't have a title unless you buy the license plate. It's taken it back to where it was before, and has been, I think probably since territorial days, that you don't have to buy a license plate for a car that never gets on a state highway. And I do not know the change that the legislature made in 1978 that changed the law, that there was some technicality and they cleaned up the Vehicle Act, well, it was brought out by the Supreme Court.
Well, you've probably seen the fiscal note, or have you?
No, I haven't.
There's a recommendation from the Department of Public Safety that the language in Section 1 be changed to read a mobile home as defined by regulation. I guess you have it before you. or a mobile home as defined in 13 AAC 40 and so on. And their concern being that the existing language may not adequately allow for titles for trailers used for planned reviews, equipment storage, etc., job sites.
I see nothing wrong at all. I think it cleans it up more.
It would have sent you, Judge.
No problem with that.
Do you have any suggestions as to which of those languages is preferable?
Mr. Chairman, I recommend that we use the first one to say by regulation, and that would allow them to change the number of meetings of future policy.
I know in the statutes, when this came up in the original bill, they had, I think it was subsection 12, but then subsection 12 in the mobile home is not defined in law, but it is by regulation, so I think this does clean it up.
Okay. What is the committee's pleasure? Shall we put out a CS with that change?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with the CS, but in this House bill, and I've got a question or two about it, I would like to hold off passing out of committee to the next one.
All right. If there's no objection to holding it, we'll hold House Bill 184 until next time.
We'll bring a CS back, please.
Yeah. Let's have a CS prepared, and we'll have a CS before the committee on Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wallace. Next, we have HCR 9, Veterans Memorial. This is a resolution passed by the House, which would call for the removal of the statue called Nimbus across the street, and in lieu thereof, put up a quote suitable memorial to honor veterans of all wars involving the United States. There are a number of issues that have been raised in connection with this. I might just bring these to your consideration, and some of them are backed up here. There's some copyright considerations. There's a letter from the National Endowment on the Arts Legal Council, NEA, initially provided funding for this, and also a legal opinion by Lynn Asper. The copyright issue is not quite resolved at this point and probably ought to be looked into further. Arts Alaska Inc. has the copyright, and so they might be able to deal with it further. There's also Nancy Scheffelberg of our staff has a memo in the file here which reviews the background of Nimbus and covers some conversations with somebody at the National Endowment for the Art, which indicates a possibility that if we do anything, remove Nimbus, we may have to reimburse the federal government for the grant.
It's worth it. I'm
sure you're not the only one who feels that way. I just want to bring this up, we have a number of people here who said they want to testify, or at least two. First one is Natalie Rothaus. Natalie, thanks.
Poor Nimbus.
How much did Nimbus cost?
How much did Nimbus cost?
$40,000, $20,000 from the federal, the NEA, $10,000 from the Alaska Court System, and $10,000 from the Alaska State Council.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Sorry, can you hear me?
We can hear fine.
My name is Natalie Rothaus. I'm Administrative Director of the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. I'm here today to speak specifically in support of the art and public places of which Nimbus was commissioned. The sculpture was a co-venture between the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency, the Alaska State Court System, and the Alaska State Council on the Arts. The Art and Public Places program has provided an opportunity for government agencies, public officials, artists, architects, engineers, builders, professionals, and arts organizations to work together for the benefit of all. The wonderful thing about public art is that it becomes the property of all the people. It is also a way of giving artists work, support, and a place to display their art. It should be government that sets the example for an aesthetically pleasing environment, one in which we are all proud to live, work, and enjoy. I would venture to say that if Nimbus is moved, there would certainly be repercussions from the National Endowment on the Arts, concerning the state of Alaska not holding up to their end of the grants agreement. Thank you.
To what extent has the Arts Council sort of dealt with people's feelings? Have you had a lot of expressions about Nimbus?
Yeah, I think everybody in this town and this state talks about Nimbus, yeah. But I think it's good in that, and that's what art is all about, and that it is an emotional issue.
Mr. Chairman, that's just it. You know, every year we have the onslaught of the Nimbus bill, and I think it's wonderful. People talk about it, they curse it, they discuss it. They're interested. It's a public property, and I would miss the bloody thing where you go.
I think it must be valid.
You know, if somebody cares enough about this to bring the issue to the floor, if we don't have other more important things before this legislature, I certainly wouldn't want to hold it in the committee, but I am a Nimbus supporter. I think that it's doing what it's supposed to do.
Mr. Chairman, you're going to have to convince me that the majority of the people want Nimbus. Convince me that the majority of people really think it means anything at all and it really belongs there. $40,000?
Nowadays, it probably costs a lot more. When was Nimbus put up?
1976. I think it started in
74.
Or
something. Okay. Thank you very much, Natalie. I just noticed that several people put down X under witness rather than putting down what bill they were covering, including the fact that Bill Brown of Division of Motor Vehicles has been here and on the previous bill. But I hope Bill can be here next week. And also noticed that Pete Kelly is here, who signed up first, so you should have been first. My apologies, I just didn't.
No problem.
I was going by numbers.
My name is Peter Kelly. I represent the Vietnam Veterans of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I just received a work draft for Senate CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 9. Speaking for the Vietnam Veterans of Alaska, we favor not the destruction of Nimbus, but just the removal to perhaps a more suitable place. We feel that a veteran's memorial would be both suiting and would be a benefit to the state capitol. Presently in the state of Alaska, there is only one memorial to veterans, and that is in the Park Strip in Anchorage, and that's a flagpole. We feel that the state capitol should provide a memorial. It might also be mentioned that public contributions will be accepted to pay for this memorial. We feel as Vietnam Veterans of Alaska that we can generate the revenues where it won't cost the state any funds. It will merely, we just need the site. As an example of this, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. was funded strictly through private contributions, and it was only the federal government only provided the space. Once again, we aren't art critics, but I think the general public of the state of Alaska has a right to its aesthetics, and I think that I've never heard any real favorable comments about Nimbus, other than it could be a memorial to government run amok. Therefore, our wish that the committee would rule favorably on this CS, and I believe that the committee's version of the resolution is a good one to provide to enter in with the court system into this and pick a suitable memorial and a proper relocation site for Nimbus.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I miss Senator Bradley. He consistently brought issues before us and stopped and made us address some things that perhaps are gone undone. And this idea of a suitable memorial for veterans is something that I think is overdue. It's not a question of that. I would assume that there are sites and locations. It's simply that I have some real concern about moving this one for a purpose. So it's not that I'm not sympathetic to the idea of a suitable memorial. I think we all should get to that. And I hope that if nothing comes out of this, but that we find a way to take action on that, then I think it's a good exercise. I appreciate your comments.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Yeah, wait a minute. Hey, I have just two items. First of all, remembering our good friend, Senator Brad Bradley, Comment to him usually was, well, we really don't have to remove Nimbus. What we can do is put a plaque on there. This is a war memorial. He never really appreciated that.
I bet he didn't.
But are you aware that the library across the street is a war memorial, the Juno Library?
No.
It was built in 1951 as a war memorial.
Okay.
And so we already have something. And maybe one way, this is just off the top of the head, maybe one way to deal with this whole issue is that we might look at this resolution possibly in terms of looking at Nimbus and or other sites, so that we might get Senator Strzelczewski and anyone else who may feel that options should be preserved. And I mark my copy here specifically that Alaska veterans deserve special recognition in Alaska's capital city, because that isn't even in here. And we just last year funded the $200,000 memorial on the Parks Highway, which is currently nearing completion. So it's not as if we're not honoring veterans. So I think what you're talking about is something in the capital city.
That would be correct, Senator. And once again, I'm sure you're all familiar that this subject raises itself every legislative session. And I think we finally have got to the point now where we say, well, I think we really should do it.
All right, let me ask you something. Which are you more interested in if you have to have a choice? Getting rid of Nimbus or getting a memorial? A veterans memorial.
Well, to be very honest, Senator, the two are hand in hand. We want a memorial on the present location of Nimbus.
Well, but let's say you couldn't have a memorial on that. Would you rather have no memorial?
Well, but Mr. Chairman,
I'm just asking. Let me ask him.
No, I think we would certainly prefer a memorial in the capital city.
All right, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's a particularly straight question. If somebody thinks that Nimbus has value, and obviously there are people who think that, then there's no problem why, then it's just a matter of location. It can be somewhere else, but, we're talking about, and this is a tourist town, and we're talking about something that thousands of people a year are going to see, and I think they'll get much more out of a suitable veterans monument there than they will out of whatever is there now. We call it Nimbus.
I'm sure this is more of a conversation piece than anything else.
Well, the House Finance Committee, we're unable to determine what the Nimbus really is. It's
Well,
okay.
Thank you, Senator. Next we have Steve Smith.
Steve Smith. I'm the president of the Southeast Alaska Visual Artists Association. And there are definitely two things that are happening here.
Excuse me. Go ahead. Why don't you reintroduce yourself so senators know who you are.
I'm Steve Smith, and I'm the president of Southeast Alaska Visual Artists Association. And HCR 9 addresses basically two things. One is the removal of Nimbus, and the other is a new sculpture, and it seemed to be put together in such a way as in one package. It isn't necessarily the way it should be done. I want to bring up a few points without going into aesthetics, and that is that I talked to the fellow who did the statue right as he was putting it in, and it is put in real well. I mean, he has the rebar sunk down 4 feet, and then the pieces has a 90-degree angle in it and bolts going down about 8, 10, 12 inches below concrete. So when we're talking about removal, we're talking about a major project. And of course, in putting the installation somewhere else, we're talking about the same type of a situation. And I just want to bring up a few items as far as cost are concerned. I don't personally believe this site is the best site for that piece of sculpture. It's not viewed well from close up. As a craftsman myself, I don't particularly think it's the best craftsmanship that could have been done. I don't think the color was what he had initially shown in his prospectus as far as what he was going to do. He showed a darker, cold blue color. He ended up with this, and even in the newspaper interview, he said, well, I mixed this color, I liked it, I put it on. We've got a situation where we have a court in front of the court building that has a lot of geometrical shapes in it all around, and it's a curvilinear shape, it's very demanding, and it's in a very tight space, and the piece would be a lot better seen in a wide open area where your eye can just come in or leave it as leisure rather than kind of be trapped by it. That's my personal feeling. To talk to artists, and most of them like parts of it, or like it, but as far as the people are concerned, I don't think it reflects particularly what we need in that spot. More people ate lunch there before Nimbus was there than do now. I like the idea of art in public places. I like the fact that it's there and it's caused a lot of controversy. As far as the new sculpture is concerned, if we're looking at something along the lines of the Ed Way sculpture down in Marine Park, the city basically paid him $40,000 for it. It's an $80,000 piece of sculpture. And I have, with my business partner, tried to solicit funds from the public to help make up the amount of money that he lost on it. And public response has not been that great. We've got money from retired people and people on limited incomes, people who have been minors, but as far as the general populace is concerned, they have not yet bought the idea of trying to support. I think it's great, the idea of getting a larger political group together to help fund its replacement. But we're talking again about probably now, between now and when something could be done, we're probably talking over $100,000. And we're also talking about removing the other statue, which just means I think we're probably in the end talking about $175,000 to $200,000 for something. I noticed on the selection committee that there's a lot of great politicians, but no artists or people that have a whole lot of knowledge of this type of work. And I think that there is it's the director of the State Council of the Arts or a designee of the director, which is generally the director is a management person. Possible he may or may not pick somebody who really has a working knowledge of sculpture and how it works. In this state, also I'd like to provision at the end concerning being commissioned to an Alaskan artist. That's real important. One of the reasons we got Nimbus was because there was federal money involved, and the selection panel had to be made up of 3 members from the national and 3 from local, and it was necessary to have a nationally known or a reputable person do the sculpture. And I saw the portfolio. He'd done much nicer pieces elsewhere, and I don't want to write down the piece too much, but it's very typical of the attitude a lot of people have. Well, you send it to Alaska and they'll never see you again, and you're gone. I have to deal with that as a businessman all the time. I don't think it's necessary, from everything I've read, as far as the letter from the National Endowment and the contract that I've seen, that we have to replace it immediately if you want to move it. If it's to be moved, I think it's commendable that people care enough about it to go to the effort of finding another selection, another spot for it. But I don't think it's inherent that it be moved and something else replace it immediately. I would like to see them addressed separately rather than jointly. I commend the Vietnam veterans for coming up with the idea of getting the public to support a new piece of sculpture. I feel, though, that we're talking in a lot of ways about polar opposites in that particular spot. If you want to put a memorial to war rather than having Nimbus there, I think it would take a lot of more thought. There are a lot of memorials to people who have died in wars, which are peace memorials. And my particular group instructed me to say that what we support is a statue, if it is all to be done in one package, which would be a tribute to all the people who have been lost at sea in Alaskan waters in the process of peace.
Massachusetts, north of Boston, that statue of a fisherman dedicated to the men that go down to the sea in ships, marvelous. Hey, Steve, let me ask you something specific. I made a note here also that probably there needs to be more artist representation And I put down sort of tentatively Juneau Arts Council. I don't know if Arts Alaska has any business, except that they were involved in the initial project. Would the Southeast Visual Artists Association be a bona fide group to consider putting onto such a committee with other organizations? Who are your members? How many do you have?
We have about 35 members who are artists in Southeast Alaska, which per capita it's a fairly good sized organization at the time. We're the only organization other than the Artist Guild, Alaska Artist Guild in Anchorage, which is a smaller group of people. I would be in favor of it as long as there's no conflict of interest when it comes to selection. I don't want to have it, because I know everybody in Southeast is about, and I don't want to.
But what we're talking about here is a committee that would make recommendations to the legislature and then probably disappear. So the committee would not necessarily be involved in implementation, but we can look into that. I'd like to do is, Milo, we're coming to you next.
I'm going to pick up something.
All right. What I'd like to do is sort of negotiate with the parties we've spoken here and maybe come back with something that everyone agrees to, and we'll bring it back next chance we have. Thank you very much for your testimony, all three of you.
Mr. Chairman, one thing though, I do think that the bottom line on House passed legislation is that members have moved and something else they discussed.
We have a title that calling for erecting a suitable memorial was involving on the site presently occupied by members, so.
Well,
let's see what we can write. we next have HCR 17, which is. Let's surprise Fritz before he gets back. I've read them, they're fine by me. So long as we deal with the CS and the flags. Do you want to move on 17?
Yes, please.
Yeah, go ahead.
We'll move CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 17, House out of Committee with unanimous due pass recommendation.
Your further recommendation, if there's no objection, we'll pass House Concurrent Resolution 17.
Mr. Chairman, I just thought that was a good, innovative, mm-hmm. good idea.
Yes.
I think that.
Representative Fritz, would you join us, please?
Thank you, Senator.
We've done you some injustice already. We just passed House Concurrent Resolution 17 where your back was turned because everyone agreed that it was a very good move.
Very seriously. Unanimously passed. It's a great idea.
Isn't that something interesting?
All members of this committee receive an honorary medal for heroism.
You can go over. This might interest you too. This thing in the first cover and inside that.
That's a great idea.
That was the basis of it, Senator. Was the.
Milo, excuse me. Would you?
My name is Milo Fritz. I'm representative from District 5 on the Kenai Peninsula. I'm here to testify in favor of House Concurrent Resolution Number 17. And since you've already
17 has passed, right?
Passed, so I didn't know, need to say anything further about that.
And now we're on House Concurrent Resolution Number 18 dealing with display of flags.
Since coming down here for the celebration of the inauguration, Senator Fisher, I've been constantly aware that during weekends and during time off that we were given for various holidays such as Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday and other state and national holidays, our flagpoles were completely devoid of either the United States flag of the United States of America, or the Alaska flag. And I thought that since this would be what you might term the hotbed of patriotism in this state, that was a very grave omission. And I think the flying of those flags during the daylight hours from 9 to 5, every day, using a flag etiquette, of course, as regards weather, is something that certainly should be taken care of in front of government buildings throughout the state. And since I believe
patriotism is one of the things that motivated my return here to the legislature and possibly yours too, Senator Fisher. I thought that this resolution was in order. And the fiscal note, as you noticed, is zero, and that it merely requires that somebody who is on duty during the holidays, either safety officers or guards, could easily be taught how to raise and lower the flag so that they would be displayed on holidays and weekends.
Thank you very much. Milo, we've prepared a proposed committee substitute that would, on lines 17 and 18 of the original, take out the word 7 days a week, just to eliminate the question that arose. We were advised there might be a significant fiscal note, because that might imply that there has to be somebody, a maintenance or a security person, has to be available to do this 7 days a week. And while you may have them in Juneau, you may not have them in Kotzebue or someplace else. So to eliminate that question, the suggestion is to eliminate the word 7 days a week, even though the intent obviously is that where these personnel are available, that's what will happen.
Senator, if that would work, that would be great. But here is where the problem really seems to be very flagrant. Here we have personnel that are on duty as security people every day and every night, all the time, and yet the flags do not fly. Now in places like Anchor Point or up in the Arctic, I'm sure that there's nobody on duty there, and perhaps that won't work out. But now, here in Juneau and in places like Anchorage and Fairbanks, it seems to me a shame that we don't fly our flags on holidays and on weekends.
I agree with you. How would it be if in that same resolve we said, further resolve, that whenever a maintenance or a security person is on duty, that person have a solemn duty to raise and so on and so forth?
That would be perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. That puts it within the realm of practical politics.
Mr. Chairman, to bring it before us, I would move for the adoption of Senate CS as we've amended here, just to bring it before us.
Okay. If there's no objection, we have Senate CS with this amendment before us now. You concur with that amendment?
Yes, I do, Senator.
If there's nothing else,
I would move the bill with individual recommendations.
Motion has been made that we report out the Senate CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 18 with individual recommendations. Thank you, Milo.
Thank you very kindly.
A pleasure. Next, we have. He wants his medal back. Next, we have House Bill 165 relating to APOC. We have no one here from APOC, or do we not? Yes.
She was supposed to be here, but she's in an LBRC meeting, I believe.
All right, let's take HB 106 first then, because I don't want to move on this bill unless we have AIPAC represented. So we'll take up 106, which is a bill to provide a bidder's preference. There are several things that are happening here that I want to make sure everyone fully realizes. The bill, HB 106, as passed by the House, provided that the preference for Alaska bidders be increased from 5% to 15% above that of the lowest non-resident bidder. As this bill came over to us, another issue arose, and that was a court decision on the Itatai and the Irby decision. So Special committee that had been appointed to work on that some time ago came up with the with proposed language, as you see in section 3 of the proposed Senate CS, which says that the joint venture, it must be composed entirely of venturers that qualify under this paragraph. And that would mean that every participant in a joint venture has to be separately qualified as an Alaska bidder to obtain the Alaska bidder's preference. We were advised by attorneys that because of some language in the court decision that we should have a statement of purpose and intent, and that is the purpose of the of section 1. Further, as we worked on this bill and in consultation with the House principal sponsor of the of HB 106, the preference, the 15% preference, is to be applied only to bids $100,000 or less, rather than right across the board. The feeling being that that should pertain more to smaller contractors and not get involved in excessive amounts. And then further, as we examined the statute, we found that there's virtually an exemption of the bidder's preference for bids led by DOT. And so we're proposing here to apply the same $100,000 preference for Alaska bidders up to the same amount of $100,000, but only if that would not interfere with receipt of federal funds. And beyond $100,000, there would be no preference under DOT bids. We have Risa King here to testify on behalf of the AGC.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Perhaps we'll be hearing from people on it. You know, this is a little bit like Nimbus. This is the bill that we have had back before us over a number of years. And I would hope there's somebody here, or maybe we could have some discussion on the memorandum regarding some possible constitutional issues. And this is one I'm seriously concerned about. If we fool around with it as to making it important enough so that somebody's going to bring a suit and we lose the 5% we have. And I have some concerns about the approach here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Risa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Risa King, and I'm here representing Associated General Contractors. We're a membership organization representing approximately 850 contractors and subcontractors, construction-related Alaska firms. We're primarily concerned about, we were concerned about the 15% increase, but we still basically, philosophically and practically, are opposed to the 5% bidder preference. From a practical standpoint, we're concerned that it increases the uncertainty in the bidding process because you don't know until later on how it's going to turn out. It increases the cost to the owner, it increases construction bidding requirements, and it decreases potential for litigation, and it also delays the awarding of projects. And further, our attorney, like Senator Sturgiewski, is concerned about the constitutionality of it, and we worry about the big picture and what it's going to mean over the long haul. And basically, that was our main concern in addressing it. At the present statute, it under present law, the university and the Alaska Power Authority projects use the 5% bidder preference, and they have been in court a lot, and a lot of their contracts could not be bid until they had actually gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and so we, which again delays it. So we would prefer that the 5% does not even exist.
So from that standpoint, you might prefer to have a bad bill that could throw out the whole thing?
I'm a little confused about the DOTs or the Power Authority. Oh, they are currently there. they're covered by it, and they have both had challenges in court.
That's
on
correct.
The, was the Power Authority on the intertie one, or is there another one?
There was other ones that I spoke with our attorney this afternoon, and he was the one that told me about this. He will be in town Thursday, and I could have him stop by and see him. So.
Is there anything else for Risa? One question. Who are the members of AGC? How many members do you have?
There's approximately 850 members.
850 members. And I assume most of them are qualified Alaska bidders.
Yes.
Okay. Has this issue been discussed in convention or in board assembly?
Quite frankly, this was an issue we were not involved with until Friday. We had a board meeting Friday, and the board members got together. It was not on my legislative report or anything, and this was one they decided to add to my list.
Okay.
No, sir.
But, you know, assuming that you did. Assuming you don't like the 5%, not to mention that it's 15%, but you would like more, although you don't like it at all, the Senate State Affairs version, I'm sure, which is
yes.
200,000.
Yes, if I stuck with taking a choice, yes.
It's your constructive comment. Thank you. Thank you, Risa. Next, we have Bob Link of the Department of Administration.
My name is Bob Link. I'm the director of the Division of General Services within the Department of Administration. We issue the bids that used to be the only ones of which applied the Alaska bidder's preference. My purpose here is just to provide any information which might be helpful as our implementation.
And, have you had any problem with the 5% bidder's preference? Any serious major problems?
No. It's easy to implement, and it's we haven't had any court suits or challenges. Mm-hmm. Discussion has happened, but that's the extent of it.
Question.
Bob, you discussed one problem with me. Two possible interpretations
of the
existing language. Could you perhaps lay that out for the committee?
Right. I read the bill as it exists right now, the amended version, and I saw two possible interpretations of the bill. One was one basically said that it would apply the 15% up to any bid. First, okay, if the non-resident bidder's bid was up to $100,000, it would apply the 15%. The other interpretation is that it would be awarded if the award did not exceed $100,000. Mm-hmm. And there is a difference there in the amount of awards.
Right.
And it would, as far as us, the application could be either direction, but if the bill were passed, we just assume carried out the way it was intended.
Which is? okay, so that's something we better clarify. Is that all?
That's all I have to say.
Mr. Chairman, no recommendation on the bill?
The recommendation I was say is that it'll add to the cost of operating in the government. Mm-hmm. Because we'll be paying more for goods.
I don't suppose we've done any kind of analysis that would say what we might be talking about.
Okay, I prepared the fiscal note based on history. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't based on the fact that it mentions two things. One, it says that what I did is went to last year and saw the premium we paid by applying the 5% bidder's preference, which I think was somewhere in the area of $20,000 to $30,000. And then went through, I believe, all of our bids and said how much would we pay if the 15% were in existence then, and that's where we came up with the $50,000, which is rounded up from about 49. It's not just a number plucked totally out of the air. What we can quantify is what happens when people say the handicap is too much, I won't participate. When that happens, then it reduces competition. When you reduce competition, you raise the cost of operations.
I might mention, by the way, that there is a May 5, 1983 House Research Agency report to Representative Barbara Locker in a file which has a lot of background on this whole bidder's preference issue that you might want to look at
right
before we take this up again. Thank you very much, Bob. Dave?
Thank you.
Chairman. I'm Dave Hutchins, representing the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Sorry I failed to sign in. The main interest that our association has in this subject of visitors' preference, twofold. One is that we very much like having a healthy construction industry in the state, people who are competent contractors that you can call on to do jobs. And in that sense, we have historically supported a modest bidder's preference. And on the other hand, we are the customers of projects built by the Power Authority, and the idea of a 15% bidder's preference on that, as in the original bill, would just be devastating to a large project. Any of the capital-intensive projects like we have in Power Authority. We recognize that the bidder's preference statute has not worked as people expected it to work. One problem was the joint venture thing, which you certainly have one way to resolve it here in this committee substitute. We like to see that resolved one way or another. Another problem that I'm not sure anybody really has talked about is that when you get into the very large contracts, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference in terms of the dollars that stay in the state, who the general contractor is. It's who the subcontractors are that really matters. And if you really want to get serious about trying to help the local construction industry in Alaska, you might look at some way to judge the bids for general contracts on the basis of the percentage of the work that will be done by in-state contractors as subs. I don't really have anything language to propose to you, but if you really want to seriously attack the problem, I think on the very large contracts, that would be the place to go after. Thank you.
How do we deal with the subcontractors there?
Well, I don't have any language to suggest, Mr. Chairman, but I think if above a certain dollar amount where you're talking about big enough projects to be worth bothering with this procedure, you can set up a procedure whereby you would be evaluating them on the basis of the percentage of the work that will be done by in-state contractors. If they're gonna sub it out to somebody, that should be counted. Perhaps you could, if you're going to use the bidder's preference, 5% on a large project, you could subtract from that on a pro rata basis the part of the work that is going to be going outside to non-Alaska qualified subcontractors.
It's a real good point. I hope you'll work with our staff and try to work something out. I'm not sure that we can.
I think it might be an appropriate topic for an interim study, even if it looks like it might be a fairly intense.
I wouldn't want to tackle it right now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no, I think the point brings up maybe a good one, but it becomes a really tough one. Anytime you set a standard, you move toward that standard, and that can be, in some cases, I think, to the detriment of in-state work. I see what you're saying, but I think there's some real practical problems with that, with attempting to come up with anything.
When you get into the really large contracts, there are very few in-state bidders who would be qualified to bid on them. And most of the work, if it's to be done by Alaska, would be done by subcontractors. And that's what we're interested in. We're going to try to have a healthy contracting board here.
Sure.
But those are the ones that we need to get the work to through the subcontracts, realizing they're not going to be able to get these jobs.
What would happen if we applied the $100,000 cap to all contracts? That would eliminate the 5% problem above, let's say, $100,000.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just if you're kind of looking at some response on that, I really feel there's a figure that's important as a preference simply because of that kind of undefinable thing that you have access almost immediately to stocks and so on. And I have been supportive of that. I think then it gets into a question of how much. And just cutting it off at $100,000 doesn't really address that problem at all.
Thank you, Dave. Is there anyone else here on Senate Bill, House Bill 106? Jim Pilas, what's your pleasure? We need to clarify the one point as to what the $100,000 applies to. And then there's a basic question of...
Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate your holding this at least until Thursday for a chance to look at the research material. Again, I have some problems, I think, with just taking a look at what other states are doing and the comment that there's a suit just waiting out there. That bothers me. So I can't give you a direction on it. Sometimes go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you get the direction during the week, let us know.
Fine. Right now, it tends to be negative toward bringing about a change that gets us into some constitutional problems.
Very good. Thank you very much. We'll hold over House Bill 106. Next, we come to Senate Bill. Is this Senate? No, this is House Bill 165, Alaska Public Offices Commission. Rick Ulin. Rick is the sponsor of the House passed bill that's before us today. And we have...
What bill number?
We're talking about 165, House Bill 165.
Mr. Chairman?
Please go ahead.
Yes, my name is Representative Rick Ewling. And I just basically, the bill before you is 165 in regard to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The original version was in the State Affairs version, which was carried through on the House side through State Affairs and the Judiciary Committee. There was an amendment that was put on the floor by Representative Terry Martin on line 14, where principal occupation and employer of the contributor are deleted. Basically, we've gone through numerous drafts. There's a lot of cleanup language in the bill. The statutes we found were very, very confusing in a lot of areas. We cleaned up quite a few things. One of the main things we did is we raised the threshold level from $100 to $250 with the concurrence of the Alaska Public Offices Commission and worked with them very, very closely to achieve that $250 threshold level, which essentially means that you would not have to report anything under $250 except on the first form of your Alaska Public Offices Commission form. I can't refer to exactly the letter number on that, but it is essentially the aggregate form, so it would just all contributions that would be under $250 would have to be listed in the aggregate. Also, a couple other things that were done as far as responsibility of a particular individual and our candidate, who was responsible for certifying. We cleaned up what certification and who was responsible for certification in a campaign. And in the case of an individual candidate, the campaign chairman, and the treasurer, it's clearly outlined in the bill that those are the people who are responsible to certify. In the case of the group, a campaign chairman and treasurer can certify. And we clarified that in the legislation before you.
Mr. Chairman? I want to compliment you, Rick, for your work on this. You know, that was before us last year, and it just went on and on and on. And I don't know whether you've had a chance to see the Senate committee substitute, but it takes out the floor amendment. I happen to support that and would appreciate that you have no objection.
I have no objection to that. It was done at the last minute on the floor, and I wasn't even aware it was going to be done. At that time, I didn't raise an objection to it. However, I'll concur with Senate, if that's the only change.
Mr. Chairman, were there other changes?
That's the only change in the proposed CS I was going to bring up. It is a one-page explanation of why this is an appropriate reinstatement.
This is your work, Senator, or Mr. Chairman. This is your...
That's from APSC. We raised a question with them, and they provided this to us to explain why this ought to be.
Just to give you an example, there was a lot of effort on the House side to eliminate two of the reporting periods out of the seven that are reported now between the primary and general election. This was a compromise that was come up to make it a little bit easier on the paperwork with the Alaska Public Offices Commission and also alleviate the problems with the paperwork for the candidate. And in past testimony, and Peter can speak to it, that this will help cut down on the paperwork and make their job easier, considering all the people that are running in the governor's campaigns, which are running in excess of $1 million.
I might say that I spent a substantial amount of time last night going over this, and having been through this bill last year, I was quite familiar. And then I went over Senator Kelly's bill from last year, which is even more comprehensive than this one. And I was wondering why some of the changes were not included, but maybe I ought to ask Theda that particular.
Well, this is a start, Theda can speak to it also, but this was a start that we could work with making some changes. She's looking at other changes further on down the line, but we felt that this was a good start. It clarifies the language in the law, and we're going to have to work with it more, but this problem.
Hey, could I ask you this?
Sure.
The bill has passed the House. It's over here. Are there any changes other than the reinstatement of that language that we ought to that you think we ought to consider at this time?
Absolutely not. I think it's a good form.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Theda Pittman. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And the Commission is very supportive of this bill if the requirement to report occupation and employer are remain as they appear now in the statute for both candidates and groups, as indicated on the material.
If
the requirement that candidates and groups report occupation and employer for their contributors, if that remains in the law rather than being deleted as
well. Let me ask you the same question I just asked Rick. Is there anything that you and or the commission feel ought to be put into this bill while it's going through the legislative process, or are you satisfied with it as is?
No, the commission is satisfied at this point. It's a little bit larger, actually, than I thought it would be when we first started. I think that the omnibus bill cannot be managed. The statute is so poor in general that the material that we have from trying to do it that way has been very helpful to me when I try to tackle, okay, now what should we put down as our priorities or just the things that we might recommend. But it's just become so complex that everyone in their uncle knows something that would be a better idea, it's just real hard to handle. I can't see it, just although I never tried to do something over the interim, I couldn't see being able to do it during a regular session.
What is the committee's pleasure on this?
Mr. Chairman, I think I like the bill, but I'd like to hold it to Thursday.
Is there any objection to holding it Thursday?
No objection. I'm ready to act defer to with Senator from Eagle River.
I'm trying to find something real nasty. APLC won't like to speak.
Our friend and benefactor, Father Kelly.
He tried.
It's a House bill, right?
Knows how to get to it, doesn't he?
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate your consideration of the rules.
I'm sure as soon as Senator Kelly's ready, we'll move it on.
I may be around if there are any specific questions that
you
have.
Okay. Miracle, we've gone through our agenda. Meeting is adjourned.
Oh,
thank you.
Great. What was the paper response to that?
Did you